Okay, so we're recording now, and for the record, this is Jen Brown. I'm here with Dr. Donna Shaver. It is March 26, 2021, and we're here to talk about her work and career with Kemp's Ridley Sea Turtles. So, for the record, do I have your permission to record?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So we'll just jump into it here, and I wanted to start at the beginning and have you tell me about your background and early life.
Well, my background is that I grew up in upstate New York. I went to Corcoran High School. It's kind of a city setting. There was, however, an area that was part of the Environmental Science and Forestry Forest that extended very close to my neighborhood. So there were a lot of woods that I was able to play in as a child. And I had a grandfather up the street who raised African violets, had a bird, fed the squirrels, had plants, and then had aquariums, including saltwater aquariums. When I was young, he was very influential in my life. I was the youngest. I have three older brothers. They went into electrical engineering fields, and I was interested in wildlife biology. And specifically, I homed in on, I was very interested in endangered species preservation. Back then, wildlife biology, I was an undergrad major. I got into Cornell University. I went to Cornell. Again, I'm from upstate New York. And it was traditional wildlife biology back then where it was focused on hunting and the game animals, the birds, the mammals, etc. But I was always interested in endangered species recovery efforts, threatened endangered species. And I read about the efforts here at Ponder Island National Seashore through a Student Conservation Association brochure back in the days when there were cork boards, real cork boards, and that's how you read about opportunities. And the SCA had opportunities all over the country, but the one that was described from here sounded ideal because it was with the Kemp's Ridley Turtles and then some other wildlife work. So I applied, and I actually was very fortunate to get the position. And so that was my start, 1980, here as an SCA intern. And between my junior and senior years of undergraduate school at Cornell, and the Kemp's Ridley population was plummeting at that time. And I was so fortunate of where I was in time and place. It was a very small program. It was the division chief who had an office that was in Flower Bluff, a seasonal employee, and myself who ran the efforts. And this was before desktop computers. And so this seasonal employee was also a professional photographer, taught me a lot about photography, and we taught me how to drive a military surplus four-wheel drive Jeep. We drove all over the island did various goat crab surveys and plant surveys and different things, and taught me a lot about the flora and fauna, and really helped me to fall in love with South Texas. So I was very moved by the plight of the Kemp's Ridley. I had a room in the trailer on the island, of the residence area, walk the beaches at night, pick up seashells, learn what they were, and had a copy of the action plan for the Kemp's Ridley on my nightstand next to my bed, and would read that, became inspired, and the population was plummeting so precipitously that some people thought it might even be too late to try to save the species. So back then, I dedicated my career to trying to help save the Kemp's Ridley turtle that was almost lost in a blink of an eye, one human generation, because primarily of the activities of man, the large scale taking of the eggs as supposed aphrodisiacs, and the incidental capture of juveniles and adults due to fisheries operations, and it was primarily shrimp trawling. And it's one human generation, 1947, and we'll talk about the riddle of the Ridley, but That's the year that very famous film was taken that shows the estimated anywhere from 26,000 to 40,000 females nesting at that primary beach in Mexico. That's when the population was robust. So that's our anchor point for the population, 1947. So what I wear, I'll show you here, keeps me motivated. It's here, one human generation. Here's my father's ring, graduation from the Naval Academy, 1947, same year as the film. And here's my graduation ring from Cornell, 1981. One human generation, we almost lost the species, and there's a little turtle inside. And so when things get hard, I remember that it was almost lost that quickly. And what I decided back then, and I knew I was going to try to do this, there was going to be a lot of sacrifices that would be involved, because as time animal husbandry is time consuming. You're tied to the animals almost as if they're little, you know, infants, where they've got needs, and you can't just go take off to go shopping and things like that. You've got responsibilities. And I was very committed, went back to Cornell with my pictures from the turtle work that I was so inspired by, and showed my wildlife biology professor, and he said, "You really like those?" Because, you know, they were scaly reptiles and not a furry mammal or a feathery bird. So I said, yeah, I really do, and this is what I want to do with my career. And so I also, at that time, in 1980, we did colonial waterbird surveys, and I met Dr. Alan Chaney, who was a professor at Texas A&I, what was Texas A&I at the time. It's now A&M Kingsville. And he was a good friend of that seasonal employee that I worked with, Tom Urban, and would be another great one for you to interview. And Dr. Chaney was major professor of a lot of graduate students who went on and did wonderful things. Dr. Wes Tunnell, who I'm sure you know about, was one of his students. Brian Chapman, Nancy Rabelais, Roger Zimmerman, just people that settled into resources positions all over South Texas and academic positions in the U.S. There was even the one that ended up in Alaska that ended up, Tom Shirley was one of his students. He had 7.5-fathom reef studies, and so a lot of them did their work there between the echinoderms and the mollusks and the crustaceans, all of those. So I decided, well, I want to go to graduate school and work with Dr. Chaney for my master's. Back then, there weren't that many turtles, so it was too risky to try to do a thesis that was based on the sea turtles. There just wasn't enough numbers to merit a master's thesis. So I decided to do a thesis on surf zone fish at Powder Island National Seashore. I love taxonomy, and fish taxonomy is really intriguing to me. So that's what I did for my master's, working there. And I had hoped that a PhD program would come along in South Texas, but it took many years, actually, after I graduated Cornell in 81, my master's from A&I in 84, and would love to have gone into a PhD program, but there wasn't one here. So it was a whole decade later before I started my PhD program with Dr. David Owens, up at Texas A&M and College Station. He's since moved on from there, but he was the major professor of Dr. Pam Plotkin, Dr. Thane Wibbles, many, many scientists, Rodon Valverde, Heather Cobb, several people in sea turtle biology, Dion Moon, people that did some great work. So I went back to work at Powder Island National Seashore as a seasonal employee in 1981. I was seasonal from 81 through 84. And then to get my foot in the door as a permanent employee, I took a dispatch position with the Ranger Division. And my philosophy was always to work hard. I cared about my work. and it wasn't a competition with anybody. There were things that needed to be done. And back in 1980, one of the maintenance guys said, "Oh, Donna, stop working too hard. You're making the rest of us look bad." And it wasn't a competition. That really didn't matter to me. But I thought, well, if all the bosses here see that I work really hard, if there's an opportunity in a different division, perhaps I can get in and then lateral back into the field that I'm interested in. And indeed, that was the opportunity that just so happened. There was a freeze on hiring to increase the number of employees, and I was on a temporary position. I had taken the test for what was called a register back then, and I was at the top of the register. So the chief ranger was able to get me for this dispatch fee collection position, which, you know, it was with a master's in biology, certainly wasn't my field, but he knew that I worked hard and that I would give it my best shot, and I'd do a good job. And it was tough to sit out the turtle work for the 9 months I was in that position before I lateraled back into my field over in what was the division then called Environmental Services, which is now the Division of Science and Resources Management. There was a lot of reorganization that went on at the park with where the turtle program resided. And that could be the source of a whole hour in itself. The program with the turtles here was begun in the mid-1970s by Mr. Robert Whistler, who is a resident of Flower Bluff and a neighbor of Dr. Henry Hildebrand. And they talked about the plight of the Kemp's Ridleys and other sea turtles. And in the 1974 resources management plan for the park, Robert Whistler put in a statement to form a secondary nesting colony of Kemp's Ridley turtles as a safeguard for the species in case some sort of an environmental or political catastrophe was to occur in Mexico. There'd be this safe area where Kemp's Ridleys could nest and be protected. Well, that morphed into him getting help from the regional chief scientist, bringing in all the other leaders from the sea turtle community worldwide and agency heads that formed this binational action plan that was the document that was at my bedside in 1980 when I first started. It's the framework that was the oversight for the work that I did here at the park. But that was also, that was the beginnings of the binational project for restoration and enhancement of the Kemp's Ridley population. Part of that binational restoration and enhancement program was, of course, the protection of the turtles at the main nesting beach in Rancho Nuevo, Mexico. But another part was this effort to form a secondary nesting colony. And another part was the head starting of the turtles after they went through our experimental imprinting and head starting work. So once we get to, you know, when I had my first position here, my beginnings and my course are merged with what's happened here at the park. So Robert was the chief naturalist. He was the chief of interpretation that oversaw resources management, which was a variety of projects with the flora and fauna here. And interpretation was interpreting it to the public, to educating them. Another name for interpretation in park service could be public education, but they call it interpretation. And they used to call those people naturalists back then, and they don't call it that anymore. But it was merged together in his division. Then when the boss I had in 1980 was Jim Woods. Before I got here, that division of interpretation was split into the environmental services that Jim Woods was the supervisor for and interpretation. Robert also started the Sea Turtle Stranding and Salvage Network in Texas in the late 1970s, before the national network was established in 1980. And his network became merged with the national network, and he became the first coordinator of the network. So he retained the Sea Turtle Stranding and Salvage Network program, whereas Environmental Services and Jim Woods was the offshoot with the nesting program. Now, further down the line, Environmental Services, as I said, became Division of Science and Resources Management. I was with that division, became, so after my stint as a dispatcher fee collector, which was very hard because I was Shy Donna from Syracuse, New York. Very, very shy, hard for me to speak in front of people. I took speech class in Cornell. One class, gave one speech, was shaking so much I ran and changed to scientific writing. And that was the only female professor that I had for any of my three degrees was my professor for scientific writing. But I so it was hard for me to be dispatcher fee collector and to go and talk to people, go knock on their RV and collect their fees for camping. But it's what I had to do because of my end goal. And slowly I became more used to talking in front of people because I had to be the voice for the turtles. I had to speak for the turtles because they couldn't speak for themselves. So I had to overcome this fear of speaking in public and my shyness so that I could do my job. And it's okay now, I'm able to do it. And I encourage those young people that work for me that it's really something that you need to try to keep working on because you need to be able to speak. It will hold you back if you cannot. And but I'm still Shy Donna from Syracuse. Don't take me to a wedding shower or a baby shower because I don't really have much to say other than turtles. Because it really is my life. I knew that I would have to make sacrifices. I didn't have any children of my own. I now have one stepson who's got two sons, but I didn't have any children of my own, and I wasn't able to maintain close friendships with college friends or outside friends. Any friends that I made was through work with media representatives or professors. Or I've kept good touch with Pam, who's one of my first employees. Dr. Nancy Character was another one of my first employees. I maintained a friendship with her, but it really took all my time and effort to do this work because I had to raise the money for it as well. So I went back to, after the stint, Shy Donna from Syracuse. During my 9 months, I did it, and I did a good job with my dispatching fee collecting. I went back to this environmental services, but my supervisor left immediately. So I was the division chief as a GS4 for 9 months of that division. And that's when I supervised Pam. And it was 1986, and I had a crew to supervise, and the superintendent wanted me to start the patrols to determine whether any turtles were coming back from this experimental imprinting and head starting project, because first of all, no one knew whether any would come back. It was experimental. A lot of people didn't think they would. And in fact, I had a crossroads in my career for a good opportunity, a good position, and I asked a professor whether he thought that any turtles from this work would come back to nest. And because that was going to make a part of my decision whether I went for this really good opportunity. And he said, no, I don't think any are going to. But I disregarded his advice and I stayed in the lower grade level, the lower money. I made many, many decisions where I stayed for the lower money. I came back for the lower money because I decided I was going to dedicate my career to trying to help save this critically endangered species that was almost lost in the blink of an eye due to human activities. So the boss left. I got a new supervisor in at that very same time. I applied and got into the Natural Resources Management Trainee Program, which allowed me to have a grade increases up to a GS9 as I went through that program. Traveled all over the country for different classes and met other, what we called ourselves creamies, you know, cream of the crop of the Park Service, the rising stars who were going to be the chiefs of resources in the future. But when I got that nine, after I was in that nine for a year, that's when that other great opportunity arose. And I talked to the chief scientist about the position as well. And he said, well, let's make you a research grade scientist. So I became a research grade scientist, GS-11. But about 9 months after that, Bruce Babbitt reorganized the researchers in Department of Interior. And he swept up all the research grade scientists from DOWOP, from Department of Interior, from National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, all of Bureau of Reclamation, all of us into this new organization called the National Biological Survey. The idea was to get the science away from the hands of the managers who might try to tinker with the results. We want the science to be independent and not influenced by these managers who may want it to come out the way they want it and who may pressure those scientists to change their findings or report them a little bit differently, which is not what science should be. So the goal was good, but the chaos that caused really uprooted and was difficult for a lot of people. Some people ended up losing their jobs over it. Because the National Biological Survey was changed to National Biological Service, which was then merged with the U.S. Geological Survey, where it still resides today, and is doing okay today. But at the beginning, it was very poorly funded, and it didn't have a lot of support in Congress, and so it was really hand-to-mouth. When I went over there, the Park Service didn't even calculate my salary correctly. It was just a mistake. It wasn't intentionally. But there wasn't even enough money to pay my salary and no money for any projects or anything else. So I went from this system in the National Park Service that relies mostly on your base funding, you're getting your money every year that you need to run your work, to project funding where you've got to raise your own money, just like that. So I had to learn to write proposals well and quickly that were going to be successful. Well, the Park Service, when I went over, and this was 1993, they said, take three turtle work with you. That's, you know, what you like most. I had also taken the Colonial Waterbird Surveys and some other scientific work with me that I was going to lead. And then when my first science center that I was affiliated with was the one in Lafayette, Louisiana, the National Wetlands Research Center. And that supervisor said, no, you specialize in one thing. It's sea turtles, it's birds, it's this or that. So, of course, I stayed with the sea turtles and they took the birds. And they were happy to get rid of the Park Service at that time was happy to get rid of the sea turtle efforts because it was dead, stinky sea turtles for the strandings. We didn't find many live ones back then. And the nesting work was still theoretical. We hadn't had any confirmed returnees come back from the experimental imprinting and head starting project, and confirmed nest records were few and far between. But although my boss had tasked me with starting the patrols in 1986, when I was my first stint as running the sea turtle work, and I have run it since 1986 here, we didn't have any money to do the patrols. It was, okay, one day rangers are going to take you down island, one day interpretation, one day maintenance, and it just didn't happen for the most part. And cast off military surplus vehicles and, you know, whatever we could use to take us down. So our patrols were very scanty and, you know, certainly not adequate to be able to accurately detect nesting. So what comes first, chicken or egg? You don't go down, you don't find it, you don't get any money because they say, well, you don't have any nests, so we don't want to give you any money because you don't have any nests. Well, but if you don't have any money, you can't go down and look and find any nests to prove that you need the money. So it was this circle that was very hard to break until we found our first confirmed returnee from this effort in 1996, a full decade after I began the patrols. And it was during that time, maybe one confirmed nest every 2 or 3 years of Kemp's Ridley that was found. So I would have to try to inspire my staff, saying, you know, have faith, they will come, have faith, and felt like Linus in the pumpkin patch, because it was really based on faith, and I'm sure a lot of people thought I was crazy, because none had come yet, but nobody knew at that time at what age Kemp's really matured in the wild. There were records that in captivity fed optimum, no threat of, you know, competition, predation. They could mature at 6 or 8 years of age. That's why they sent me out to patrol then. But we ended up finding out that our records of our head starts are anywhere from 10 to 16 years of age before they first nest. And I've got a publication that lists all the reasons why it was difficult to confirm, difficult to get those records, because we didn't have money to find turtles, go to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, say, we need, you know, it's nesting, we need money from you. No, go to U.S., go to NOAA, because those are head-started turtles. NOAA did that, and NOAA would turn me back to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They'd point like this, and it's, you can't get blood out of a turnip. So you have to go elsewhere to look for money. And what my savior for my first successful grants were the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation through the Shell Marine Habitat Program. And I was very, very grateful to them, because that's all I had for a while. And then over time, I started building up more funding, because my proposals became more successful. They were able to build on themselves that we had this these returnees now confirmed, and we're coming back, and helped justify getting more money. When we had our first confirmed returnees come back, then the Park Service was interested in the program again. The regional chief, director came down for pictures, the New York Times and Washington Post. Big deal with the release of the hatchlings, very splashy. It was in all kinds of newspapers, and back in the days when newspapers were still, you know, really big thing in the media. They've since lost some of their popularity with online alternatives. But it was very, very big news, because this was the first time that an experimentally imprinted turtle was confirmed to have returned to nest, the first time a head-started turtle had nested in the wild, and the first nesting in the wild of known-aged Kemp's Ridley turtle. So scientifically, it was big news, and I ended up being asked by the government of the Canary Islands to go over and help advise them on our procedures, because they wanted to do something similar. And so that's been part of my obligation to try to get these records too, is scientifically, I believe it's important to know how many of these turtles came back to nest, and their characteristics. Did they nest similarly to wild turtles in terms of the number of nests, the number of eggs, their sight fidelity, and some of these characteristics, their size, their behavior? And during the course of the efforts, head starting became a bad thing in sea turtle community. Jack Woody had been the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sea turtle coordinator, and he'd viewed turtles being head started elsewhere in the world in really deplorable conditions, and he wanted to see that stop. And also, he did not want to see head starting used as an excuse to continue to capture a lot of turtles in the marine environment. He wanted to see turtle excluder devices used. Don't just put more turtles out there. Protect the turtles that are in the waters now. So to do that, he made head starting bad. He didn't have the data to base that on. It just was declared. And because he was so charismatic and this Bengali figure, the sea turtle community followed. And almost, and it's kind of embarrassing, but a sheep-like mentality. And so it became difficult for me to even get my first records published, because they didn't want to hear about head-starting turtles nesting in the wild, because of the fear of that practice being misused. So that was a big challenge for us. And I even was called when I had the first records by someone from NOAA who accused me of lying about those records. And I said, no, I'm not lying. These are bona fide records, and it's, you know, it is what it is. Let's find out what's happened with these turtles. I'm not advocating for this procedure. I just want to find out from a scientific perspective what's happened. And we have a moral obligation. If we've caused those turtles to nest here, we have an obligation to protect them when they're nested here. We need to be out there looking for them and protect them so that they're not harmed by predators or run over inadvertently by, you know, beach drivers, because we have the Texas Open Beaches Act. Our beaches are open to beach driving. So over time, I've developed a program that's a two-pronged effort, and it always has been since 86, of public education and beach patrols to find these nesting turtles that are the most critically, still remain, the most critically endangered sea turtle species in the world that nests almost exclusively in the Western Gulf. We now have about 1% of the kestrels that nest worldwide are nesting here. We've come up, and that's great. It's considered one genetic stock and one management unit. But the pioneers started this work because they believed it was not safe to have all your eggs in one basket of Rancho Nuevo, one beach, in case a political or environmental catastrophe occurred. And now we face what they didn't realize: climate change, beaches eroding, beach temperatures increasing. Incubation temperature determines the sex of these turtles. Some nesting beaches are producing 100% female. Well, you cannot sustain a population with 100% female. So they are having to manage where they move nests to cooler areas. They shade nests, they water nests. Some beaches worldwide, they're finding that they're reaching lethal temperatures. The eggs are getting too hot and it's killing the developing embryos. So again, you can't sustain a population like that. You've got to do some of those things I just mentioned. Along the way, relocation of nests by the same man is judged as bad. And it's been followed in a similar manner. And for Head Starting, they tried to cobble together some information, hold a blue ribbon panel to say it was bad, but they did it before they even had a chance to see whether any of our turtles returned. And they didn't give us any funding to find the turtles. And the turtles from the earliest years weren't marked well. And I've got a 60-page publication that discusses this. It made it really difficult for us to be able to document the turtles and quantify how many there were that returned. In the first years, the Head Starter turtles were released off the coast of Florida, and nobody was, you know, looking for a release to nest over there. And the first records of Ridley's nesting in Florida, the biologists hypothesized that perhaps those were Head Starter individuals. So we'll never really know how many of our pod round and printed Head Starter turtles nested in the wild, just because the data collection efforts were not robust enough. But I needed to do what I could to try to get the records that we could. And again, to protect these turtles when they're nesting here and others from the wild stock that were repopulating the area, because Kemp's really is a native nester to this area. That's why one of the reasons we were selected for this effort to form a secondary nesting colony is that Powder Island National Seashore preserves the longest stretch of undeveloped Barrier Island beach in the United States. We could protect the nesting turtles, the nests, and the habitat. And Kemp's Relief is a native nester. The first documented records of Kemp's Relief nesting anywhere worldwide was before I have to back up and give you some earlier history, but before this famous film that was taken in 1947 showing you those estimated 26 to 40,000 females nesting on the beach. Before that film was found in the early 60s by Dr. Henry Hildebrand in the late 1940s, 1949, there were records of Kemp's Relief nesting at the National Seashore before it became designated a National Seashore. Those were published in the early 50s. first records best anywhere in the world were here. So it's some of the naysayers want to say, oh, well, you put them all here. No, we didn't put them all here. It is a reestablishment. And there's some information that they nested in fairly substantial numbers here at one time. But we don't know for sure. This area was a grazing area. It was a bombing range. It's remote. And temps really are very difficult to find nesting. They tend to nest on windy days. Their tracks blow away quickly. These are days where you don't want to be on the beach because you're sandblasted, or days where these strong fronts come through, like in, and you know, the March comes in like a lamb goes out like a lion, or you know, the very severe weather we can get with tornadoes even in March and April, those type of fronts. That's the weather these turtles like before, during, or after, when people wouldn't necessarily have been out on the beach. And even people that are seasoned pros can drive right by a nesting ridley. They're hard to see. The tracks are hard to see. So we don't have good information on the historic levels, but we do know it was a historical nesting. So, I was in USGS, started bringing in money as the head started turtle started nesting. And a lot of media attention. And then the Park Service wanted the program back, and they wanted me back. And they begged for about 5 years for me to come back to them. And they said, we started this program, we love this work, we want it to come back, we want you to come back. And to do that, I had to give up my research grade evaluation position. And in those positions, every 4 years, your packet is evaluated, and much like a tenure track for a professor, you can get promotion. And promotion, if you do well, get a lot of publications. Your publications make an impact. Get promotion. Your expected final grade level is GS-15. I would have been a GS-15 had I stayed in there, in the USGS. I have a colleague that's doing sea turtles. She's GS-15. She's 10 years younger than me. I came back over to the Park Service because of their promises to support the project. They loved the project. They would support me. They wanted me back. I had two employees that were very faithful, that deserved a career path, Cynthia Rubio, Jennifer Shelby Walker. Wanted them to have a chance at a career. USGS wasn't going to allow me to have any permanent federal positions, only contract positions. And a federal position is a more secure, more prestigious, a better position for their families. I wasn't going to be like when I first started in 1980, and I had a man tell me, oh, these women in the Park Service taking the jobs away from the breadwinners, the families. It's not like that anymore. We need two breadwinners. And because I did face sexual harassment and sexual discrimination early in my career, it's been very important to me to have an inclusive work environment where everybody is welcome, and I give women a chance, and they don't face the same sort of things that I faced. And so I've tried to do that, and so I came back, and I came back as a 13, knowing that the 15 was going to be out of reach after then, but thinking it was the best thing for the turtles because the Park Service said that they would support them. And said, we'll work with you to get a base increase so you'll have this permanent year-to-year money to support the work. So I came back under a core-mediated transfer agreement to the Park Service, and I worked with the Park Service. And I did everything they did. I did everything that they asked. All of our work was funded under money that I brought in. It's very time consuming. You know, writing proposals, writing a good proposal takes about 40 hours. So that takes your nights, your weekends, your holidays. But it was important because we had this scientific obligation and this humanitarian obligation to protect these turtles that they nest here. And also the stranding network. You know, the turtles were coming whether we were going to be ready or not, despite any squabbling or politics or Republican or Democrat or whatever. The turtles were programmed and they're coming. We need to be ready. Some projects can be deferred, but the turtles were going to be coming. So had to be ready. So I worked with the Park Service, brought in that base funding that gave the permanent base money needed for the division. When I first came back in 2003, so I was with USGS from 93 to 2003. When I first came back in 2003, the base for our division was very small, and I could have come back, I could have had my packet reevaluated by USGS to get a 14. They said, don't do it, you're going to get it in a year, you're just a point away. But I didn't do it because the Park Service base I was coming back to was small, and I didn't want to take up all those funds with my salary. And then when I came back to the Park Service, they did a coordinated transfer agreement that said I would be a division chief leader and I'd have these responsibilities. I'd work with all five species. I would get to choose the projects for sea turtles that I worked on and, you know, have the authority to speak with the media and run my program as I had in USGS as a field station leader, the Ponder Island Field Research Station leader for the USGS. I was here, but it just was a different shirt, a different hat, doing very, very similar work, but with more, it was a more prestigious position because it was a research position, and more emphasis was put on the research part of it. But my work was always a mix too, so I didn't fit in perfectly with anybody. My work is a mix of Fish and Wildlife Service, who I haven't worked for yet, National Park Service, and USGS, because it's conservation and interpretation from all the above. It's got public education, conservation, research, endangered species. So they said when I came back and they did my PD for the Park Service in 2003, well, have it done in a year, you'll be a 14. It's your position is just, you know, score is just really close to a 14. And again, because our base at that time was so small, I didn't want to take more of that scanty little bit of money for me. My view then was I'm going to work till I'm old and gray. It just doesn't matter. I want to take care of the turtles. I want to have enough work to, I want to have enough money to be able to do the work I need to go out and find and document and protect these turtles and their eggs. And, so over time, my proposals were successful. I did get that base increase. And the last installment was 2010 that I could have gone after the 14 then, but I was, you know, getting ready to think about it, and then Deepwater Horizon happened. And Department of Interior came knocking on my door and said, Donna, you've got a baseline of data now. We've had nesting increased. You see, you can show the figure of the increased nesting. And then they add that into the documentation. Nesting's increased. It was increasing exponentially up until 2009. And so you've got a baseline. We want you to be the principal investigator for the NERDA study to determine the impacts of the deep water spill to the nesting turtles and the eggs. We want you to be the leader for a carcass litigation hold for carcasses that are found washed ashore stranded in South Texas. You need to write the restoration proposals for all the sea turtle nesting and stranding projects in Texas, along with it used to be Tom Shear from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office in Corpus Christi, and then it's become Mary Case Grupa the last 2 or 3 years. And that work was really hard because it was very, very, there was a lot of argument among the trustees of how to do it, a lot of brilliant minds about toxicology, which is not my field, of how these specimens should be collected and prepared and preserved, but then after that they had to be chain of custody, locked up, and then go into the collecting of data, the building of case, so that if we went to court, we could get restitution for the American public for the damage done to their resources by the spill. And I felt honored to do that. We collected a baseline a day that could be used for this study, for this species. I felt like this was my duty. They didn't feel like they could do it in Mexico because of all the chain of custody requirements and the details that need to be done from each nesting turtle that was found. The numbers down there were too big to be able to do some of those things. So it was a lot of work, a lot of disagreements with other trustees, and very elaborate deadlines, and elaborate reports, and proposals, and they had to go through a lot of people. Very time-consuming. It was a whole other job on top of my regular job. There were a lot of people during the deep water, and even still, they got a separate position just to work on the deep water spill. I was doing it on top of my regular work. Luckily, we got some extra money to help fund that, so we got some extra positions. And then I went through an exercise with them for emergency restoration funding, and afterwards heard from the lawyers. It was all done in good faith, and it was hundreds of hours of work. Heard from the lawyers of, oh, gee, I didn't know, Donna, but they were never going to give you any money. It was just a stalling technique. I was like, man, you know, I got a lot of things I'm doing here. I didn't have time to be used as a stalling technique, but I was. I got back up on the horse and kept going. Okay, we're going to do early restoration. This is before the settlement happened. So we did the proposals, and we got it funded, the early restoration before the settlement. And it actually got finalized right as the settlement was occurring. So what had kept me going during this work was I was told that this work was going to result in restoration funding for all of the Kemp's-Early nesting projects in the state, and there are five, and then the Kemp's-Early nesting project, the main nesting beach at Rancho Nuevo. And all of the projects, all of us needed funding to help with the work, but the nest numbers had gone up. When my pace increase proposals went in, that was the early 2000s. Numbers have gone up. Inflation has occurred. Everybody needed more money, so they got more money. 10 years for everyone for their nesting work. And it's not the whole money, but it is to support the work. So you can do more to aid with the restoration of the species. That money is to do more than what you did before, for strandings and for nesting. We at Padre An got 5 years instead of 10 years, and there's been differences of why we were told we got 5 years. And then we were allowed to stretch it for 10 years, and people said, oh, they got 10 years. Well, didn't really. We were allowed to stretch it. We were told we'd go after the next 5 years, the next phase of restoration, and then when it came to that, it didn't happen, and our chances of that were greatly minimized because my edits in the draft strategic framework for the restoration of sea turtles in the Gulf, I was asked to work on a lot of plans throughout the whole thing. A lot of documents. I always got them in on time. Always did them. When I was on vacation, I'd be on conference calls. Tell my husband, you got to go out to eat by yourself. You've got to go walk by yourself. Got to work on this deep water stuff. So I did everything I was asked to, and then my edits in the draft strategic framework for our Texas priorities were intentionally disregarded. So we lost out on our proposals still could be submitted, but they didn't have as much sway as if they'd been listed as priorities in that framework. And that kind of takes us up to the history of everything. So I was at a crossroads and had to decide, well, what do you do? You've been named to be in charge of writing the proposals for these Texas projects. And I didn't know that they'd been intentionally, you know, I saw the document twice, and twice I put those edits in, and I didn't see the finalized priorities until I watched a Ocean Conservancy webinar that listed these priorities, and about fell off my seat when I saw them. And then I did a Google search and I found the document online. And sure enough, there it was. And so when I found that out, you know, what do you do? Do you just live with it, or do you try to find someone else in your agency to try to help advocate for your proposals so that they could stand a chance of getting funding? And that's where I am today, is because of what I did with that. But the work has been incredible. I wouldn't change my career choice for anything. Although there are some days I say I would, because everybody's job gets frustrating at times, bureaucracy, etc. But the people that I've met and worked with have been phenomenal. The volunteers, every year we get 100 to 200 volunteers between the cold stunning and the strand and the nesting work. It can be more than 200 a year. The seasonal staff, the other staff members that have worked for me, and superintendents, head and regional personnel and WASO personnel love this work. They come down from the regional office and from the Washington office to tell us how much they love this work. After the returnees came back and we were on the course and got the base increase to, you know, we were going to keep at it. We made a commitment, we started it, and they loved it and kept coming down and telling the staff that until recently. And it's been just a wonderful thing to be involved in, and I felt like the sacrifices that I made were minimum in comparison to what is the value of the species forever for next generations. And when you see a nesting turtle and you'll have somebody there and they'll be in awe, and when are the eggs going to hatch? Where's the hatchlings? You can feel the sand move, the vibrations up through your legs as the female tamps down the sand in this ritual that this species has gone through for millions of years, that somehow they know this is the day. But we can guess, says all the ingredients of a great nesting day. We'll be all ready and beef up our coverage. And I say, we got all dressed for the party and the star didn't come. But somehow they know which is their day, which has the perfect ingredients, and then they're up nesting and we've started to see our bottom behavior form here. I haven't gotten to see two turtles in one place at one time, but I've had staff members, about five different staff members who've seen it and say, well, I see another one coming. As well, get this one done, documented, and document the other. And the procedures have changed over time. It used to be that Cynthia and I, so let me go back to Cynthia. So after we had the first confirmed returnee in 1996, I was in graduate school with Dr. David Owens, and said, Dr. Owens, we had confirmed returnee, it's a new day, we could have nesting now, I think we need to be ready for a nesting colony to form, become reestablished. I need someone to help me find nests and help me find nests quickly. He said, get Cynthia Rubio. She's worked in Mexico and she's worked at sea turtling. So I got her starting in 1997. And she's been with the program ever since, and she's the right-hand person, the biologist in the division. And she's, we worked her through a career ladder, and she said she has 11. She had a career for her family. And that's important. And she's brought great things to the program, integrating procedures that she learned in Mexico. And I want to stress that our procedures for management are very similar to what has been used in Mexico for decades that worked to help save the species. For decades, virtually every nest that was found was brought into a protective corral, it's a big screen enclosure, and planted there so that the poachers wouldn't take it, predators wouldn't take it, high tides wouldn't take it. And that over time, finally, it got to a low point in 85, got heard, and we had a first confirmed return in 86, and then, 85 was the low point, 96 was the first confirmed returnee, got her in 97. 85 the low point, and it's been growing since then. The relocation of those eggs helped save the species, along with the mandatory use of turtle excluder devices. So people who say relocation will devastate, will cause them to be irreparably harmed, you're not looking at the objective evidence science of how the population increased exponentially after virtually every clutch was put into a protective corral. There's your evidence right there. So we are retrieving every nest that we find for protected care, either in my incubation facility or in our corral down island. So over time, as nesting started to grow, at first, Cynthia and I would have to look at all the nest sites because there were so few. We wanted to make sure everything was done right. And then as they started to grow, we had to train our people to be able to do the data collection. Since we can't get to them. Our area, we've got 60 miles of beachfront but no road behind the dunes. You do not get anywhere fast. So we have to have a camp that's established at mile 39. And then people have routes that I've devised over time, perfected them, staying up at night thinking, okay, how do I get the timing with the resources I've got so hopefully somebody can cross every point in the route during daylight hours every 45 minutes because it takes about 45 minutes for those turtles to nest from the time they come out of the water, they lay their eggs, and they go back. We want to be able to see the turtles if we can because we want to see their tags, document them. And if we see the turtles, it makes it easier to find where the nest is located. If you don't, then you can just have this blown out area we call blown out tracks. And you can have to spend hours looking for where that nest is. So Cynthia learned down in Mexico how to probe to try to find the nest. It can be a needle in a haystack, literally, like a crime scene. You're looking for a piece of flipped up vegetation, flipped up sand. Try to project where those two sides of the tracks intersect. The chemists are masters at covering up where their nest is located. And she taught me and the others how to probe. You look for the soft sand at the neck of the nest chamber, and it gives in. Now, when they're looking for avalanche victims or to find pipes, people that are preparing your pipes in your yard, they're looking for something hard, we're looking for something soft, and it gives in. But it gives in for crab holes, it gives in for other holes that people dig when their vehicle's stuck, etc. So it can be time consuming. And then about 15 years ago, I trained my little dog, Ridley Ranger. He's a Cairn Terrier, and he was in Bark Magazine, Family Dog, all kinds of books, Scholastic Magazine. Trained him to find nests that were the most difficult to find, where we spent hours and hours looking and we couldn't find it. And he did it, and he loved it. And I trained another one of my Cairns, Kaylee, and now I've got a brand new one. Kaylee was the last of the three that passed on a few months ago, and now we've got Tempy, K-E-M-P-Y. He's only about 10 weeks old, but he's going to go through training too. He's very smart. I think he'll get the knack. And what that does, that helps with public education and bringing in a sector of society that might not have paid attention to our turtle program before, but all of a sudden, because they love dogs, love Cairn Terriers, they're going to learn about our program, be interested in helping with it. And that public education is critical. And our volunteers, our ambassadors, going out and talking to their friends and their neighbors. And they've got time to go out to dinner, lunch, and shopping things, and talk about what they do. I volunteer. They're really proud to do it. And they feel like they're giving back. And because about up to half of the time, the nests are found because of reports from the public or of other people that are working on the beach during the nesting season. So we do extensive public education efforts, my program, as well as our interpretation division here, and all the other nesting programs on the coast. And we train others like lifeguards, beach maintenance crews, etc., because they may find them. They do. Every year, some do. And our patrollers get frustrated because they could drive by and 5 minutes later, this couple from Indiana who's never been on the beach before, finds their turtle. Yeah, sorry. Sorry. You know, it's a team. You have to instill that it's a team effort. And really, every nest found is a victory. Those eggs represent our hopes for the next generation. The females have the highest reproductive value to the population because it's thought that in the recovery plan that you can get online, it's thought that 1 in 400 eggs will produce an individual that survives to adulthood. So for every adult, many others didn't make it. When those females come up and lay their eggs, they crawl up the beach, they'll find a place where they want a nest. It can be anywhere from the high tide line all the way up into the dunes, maybe behind the first dune line, you don't even see them. They'll dig a hole with their rear flippers, and then they'll be virtually motionless when they're laying their eggs for about 15 minutes. They may have some sand on them, especially if it's breezy. They tend to nest in the soft sand of the beach vehicular roadway, where they are sitting ducks. If you don't see them, they will not move out of the way. Not a, like a deer or a rabbit or even a ghost crab. It's going to try to move away. They cannot. It's not in their makeup at that point when they're laying eggs to move. And we've had two of them that were run over and killed on South Padre. Knock on wood, we haven't had any here at the National Seashore. But that's one of the reasons that our coverage is so important, because it is the mitigation, it is the primary mitigation measure that allows this balance of recreational access and conservation. I tell people, it doesn't matter what my personal view about beach driving is. I have to manage with the reality of the regulations and policies and laws that are here. And the Texas Open Beaches Act is part of the Texas Constitution, and many Texans view beach driving as their God-given right. And we almost got ran out of town over just reducing the speed limit here during the nesting season and heavy visitation season to 15 miles per hour, which is the same speed as in the whole rest of the state. It was very, very difficult to do. A lot of political backlash by a lot of user groups. And so we know the power of these groups. You know, someday if somebody does this, then we'll, you know, look at our management. But our nest relocation also, though, is critical because it protects. And Dr. Tussaud at the Blucher Institute is one of my great colleagues for collaboration with the water temperatures and cold stunning, but also for the beach profiles and nuisance coastal flooding and inundation. The nuisance coastal flooding occurs 90 days per year on the coastal bend area and is predicted to increase exponentially. And he is convinced that our nest relocation is an essential ingredient of our nest protection program at this time. It protects against predators, and there's all kinds. Badgers, skunks, coyotes, raccoons, ghost crabs, fire ants, and then with the hatchlings, the birds too. And we have had hatchlings run over by vehicles. You can't see them. Hemp's release nests mostly during the day, but sometimes at night. The hatchlings emerge mostly from a little before dusk all the way through the night up until about 10 in the morning, but sometimes even during the middle of the day. So people from other states would say, well, just close your beach at night and then you'll protect the animals. No, the habits of this species are different than your threatened loggerheads and greens that nest and hatch mostly at night. It's much easier nut to crack than ours is. So it's important to keep the funding coming in, and funding is now, I thought I was in good shape. I was going to, we're trying to get access to the restoration money for when the early restoration money runs out in 5 years, but then the existing money that I have and thought I had is now in jeopardy. So back in the soup of having to figure out how we're going to fund this work. And we work into the future and hope that we can continue it, because it's important. The public public releases of our hatchlings when we've been able to hold them. We couldn't last year because of COVID. We did hold them by social media, and they almost reached 1 million people, those Facebook Live broadcasts of those social media. And I invited special guests to help narrate each one. Dr. Trousseau was one, Nick Meyer was one. I don't even recall the others, but people that have important roles in the sea turtle conservation or the conservation overall in the area to be guest hosts, because I don't care for my voice. I wanted to hear some other, you know, have some other people speak besides just me. And people get tired of hearing my voice narrate them, I would think. I get tired of hearing. This year, I'm not sure what we'll do with COVID. We may not be able to have them again, but hopefully, you know, in 2 years we could. But some people don't want to have them, which it very much saddens me, because they're a critical environmental education tool. That saying about conserving an animal because you see it and you can love it, you've learned about it, it's true. And we get, collectively for our 20 to 25 public releases a year, we get about 16,000 people that come out and view them. Grown men, literally, with tears in their eyes. Many people tell me this is their bucket list item, that people from indigenous tribes in Oklahoma coming down and telling me the turtle is very significant to our culture and we wanted to see this release. And other people that have driven in and people that are staying overnight, because it's not turtles on demand. These are releases when the turtles are ready to be released. They're all held in accordance with the natural timing of when these turtles enter the frenzy and would need to be released anyway. So the people are able to join in and watch what would be occurring anyway. It's win-win. The little kids run to be in the front row, and it's just a wonderful thing to see. Absolutely wonderful. And very rewarding. It's the icing on the cake after all the hard work. So I've already gone to 9:21, and you've only got 10 minutes left, and I don't know which questions I haven't answered.
Okay, let's see. Well, why did you want to get interested, or why were you interested in endangered species when you went to college?
I was interested in them because I wanted to help something that couldn't help themselves, specifically. Early on, I was interested in animals very much. And before I settled in on endangered species, I either want to help abused children or I want to help threaten or endangered species, something that man caused this decline. And we've got an obligation to help, just like with the abused children. But because I'm shy down from Syracuse, I picked the animals. And I'm better suited to that. I mean, that would have been really a heartbreak, but that's a critical field for the right person to get into. But I was interested in wildlife, but I wanted to help those that... I have nothing against hunting and fishing at all, and there's definitely a place and people that manage those, but I wanted to manage these that had really been harmed by man.
Okay. I'm trying to go... We've covered a lot of what I wanted to talk about. Were you involved in the TEDS and the regulation at all, or were you just advocating for their use?
Well, you have to be careful with the word advocating, because really at no time have I been in a position to be, and you've got to watch out with that word advocating, because then it gets close to something like Hatch Act, something that a federal employee can't do. TEDS became mandatory during the time when I was working with sea turtles. I had a lot to do with documenting that when they were mandatory, they were not working properly. And there were what were called bottom shooting TEDS, and they didn't have a float rule. So they just drug along the bottom, and they were still continuing to catch turtles. And I had reported this to no one. Boy, they got really mad at me. My whole career was on TEDs. TEDs are critical. TEDs are important. But something's not working about them. You need to look at them. That was hard to do. This was like a GS muckety muck, and I was, level. But you could see from the stranding data, the large dead Ridleys, the large dead loggerheads being found here, that something was wrong. And also that the opening size was smaller in the Gulf than the Atlantic. So I worked a lot with providing stranding data to help say that, hey, the TEDs aren't doing as much as we need them to do, that opening size needs to be larger and consistent in both the Gulf and the Atlantic. And that happened. And then I had a huge amount with the Texas Parks and Wildlife revision of their shrimp fishery management plan, where I felt like I worked for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for a whole year, where I gave them satellite tracking data, nesting data, stranding data, because more dead adult Cass Ridleys were being found at Potterau National Seashore in South Texas than any other location in the U.S. And this was before our numbers started to rise. It was, pregnant female getting to the door of the hospital then getting mowed down. Not good. So they Texas Parks and Wildlife oversaw the shrimp fishery, and also they had oversight of threatened and endangered species in Texas. So they revised their shrimp fishery management plan to develop a closed area off of South Texas to shrimp trawling from December 1st through May 15th, up to 5 nautical miles. And that's for South Texas, Corpus Christi Fish Pass down to the U.S.-Mexico border. And then from May 15th through July 15th is the annual Texas closure out to 200 nautical miles. It's been in existence for years and years, not developed for turtles, but turtles do benefit. Once that closed area was made and then was patrolled and enforced, then our nest numbers started to increase in Texas. So Mike Ray from Parks and Wildlife and I are very proud of that. That was a huge accomplishment. That was important for conservation.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, using scientific data. That's what a scientist wants, that your data be used to help with the management. And I just started a few years before my satellite tracking of adult Kemp's Ridley turtles with the hope that, because we were having all these dead adults, maybe somebody would have the fortitude to develop a closed area to protect these turtles in this protected swimway between their primary nesting grounds off the northern Gulf, their main nesting beach in Mexico, but also those that were nesting here. And they did. Parks and Wildlife did. So
can you tell me, just to end on, what's been your most memorable experience working with Kemp's Ridleys?
My most memorable experience, I got to give you two. Most memorable would be, of course, the first location, the first head-started turtle that I documented nesting on the beach, jumping up and down, being so excited because it was experimental. Nobody knew whether it would work. And here was one right in front of my eyes, opening up all possibilities. And just a couple months ago, I was coming into the park and I introduced myself to a ranger that was working the feed station. I said, "Oh, I'm Don Shaver, I run the turtle program." He said, "I know who you are. I met you in 1996 when you found that first confirmed returnee. You were jumping up and down. You were so excited. You told me all about it." And those two things combined really are important to me because it reminds you that what you're doing can make a difference. You never know when that may be just an encounter on the beach of a day that was so important to me, and it influenced his life to come be a park ranger someday. And it's important for science, and it's important for people. And that's my other aspect of it, is finding that turtle, and then the people connection, the influence that this work has had on the people that have come through as part of this program. I just had another one write me yesterday who got his PhD, and he's a professor. And to know that, I call them graduates of the program. We have about 30 every year, 30 seasonals from all around the world. They're in between their BS and their master's, or going off to other jobs. And so this is a stepping stone early in their career. And now that I'm older, they tell me, well, Donna, I'll have women that will come to me. Literally, I've had multiple do this with tears in their eyes saying, Donna, I just want to thank you for hiring me and letting me work here this summer. It's so important to me to have a strong female role model in science, running a scientific program, especially in South Texas. It meant a lot to me. And when I hear that, I it's really sobering to go from the youngest, which I was, to now my role in helping mentor and train, get the publications done before I retire, try to train people to pass the torch, because it would be such a pity if this work died. It must continue, and so now I'm trying to work on the steps. It isn't going to be quick. People want to yank me out of here. I have two people say, two supervisors, oh, you're 60, why don't you retire? No, I still have a lot of work to do. That was never my plan. And if I did, I would really hurt financially because I made those moves to go for the lower grade. And I wouldn't be retirement age yet. Got to be 67, got like everybody else, Social Security. So now my role, really important, is helping the mentor. So I'm taking care of the turtles, I'm taking care of the people that hopefully someday will take care of the turtles.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I think you probably have meetings and nesting and everything, but is there anything else you want to add? I hope we could do this again in the future, because I think I still had questions.
Let's do again, because I know I didn't let you do it in a question format.
That's fine. I usually like to let people talk, so.
Okay. Well, you can go through and see what I didn't answer, and then we can hit those.
Okay. I think also, I have your publications and the stuff that you had sent, so I might be able to fill in some gaps there, but I might... I'll let you know if I have any more questions.
It's my pleasure. I can see some things like talk about Dr. Hildebrand. I need to do that. And we're talking about my experience with Pam. She was one of my first employees and how proud I am that she went on to be the first female head of Texas Sea Grant. There's things to cover. So we can set up again. Now that you've got permission, I think it's probably okay.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. You take care. And if you'd like, I'll be hearing from you again.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Bye.